From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just over a decade ago in Montana. A journalist named Ben Goldfarb was there to write a series of articles, and it was one story in particular that caught his attention, a story about wildlife crossing structures, overpasses, underpasses, on Highway 93 north of Missoula, not for humans, but for everyone who is not a human. Ben had joined a road ecology scholar, and what he found was profound to him. As he would later say, we do so much on this planet to make animals' lives harder, more miserable, more deadly. And here, he found, was the opposite, a piece of infrastructure intentionally created to protect and assist animals. He thought about bobcats and coyote, elk and moose. Instead of dying on the road created for cars, they were using a new piece of infrastructure that served as an animal overpass. And as he literally watched animals safely cross over a cement roadway, he began to consider just how big this issue was. As it turns out, it's huge. Goldfarb envisions a distant future when an alien civilization arrives on Earth to find the remnants of human life here, and they conclude that, well, whoever we were, our reason for existing must have been to just build a lot of roads. 40 million miles of roads at this moment, encircling the planet. In his new book, Goldfarb writes, quote, to us, roads signify connection and escape. To other life forms, they spell death and division. Sometime during the 20th century, scientists have written, roadkill surpassed hunting as the leading direct human cause of vertebrate mortality on land, end quote. And the numbers are staggering. 1 million animals killed on the roadway in the United States every day. 1 in 8 land-dwelling mammals will die on a roadway. And so it seems clear enough that there are deep consequences to this kind of loss. But Goldfarb writes that the existence of roadways has other effects. Some animals will change where they live to avoid the roads. It can affect food sources, migration, habitat loss. Goldfarb writes, quote, if you're a Kerouac reader, you grew up steeped in the dogma that highways represent freedom. If you're a grizzly bear, they might as well be prison walls, end quote. Now, Goldfarb does not prescribe the end of all roads as we know them. He does ask us to consider solutions that take more living beings into consideration, and there are plenty of innovators out there that he details in the book doing that work today. His book is called Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. Goldfarb will be in Buffalo for an event with the Western New York Land Conservancy 2 weeks from today. But first, he joins us on Connections. Ben Goldfarb, welcome. Thank you for making time for the program.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
And Marisa Rigi is with us in studio, Executive Director of the Western New York Land Conservancy, and very excited about this event that's coming up in a couple of weeks. Is that right there?
Yes, I'm thrilled. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you for being here, Marisa. It's an evening with conservation journalist Ben Goldfarb. It's happening 2 weeks from tonight, 7 p.m. at the Trinity Episcopal Church in Buffalo, New York. Who do you want to see there 2 weeks from tonight, Marisa?
Everyone who is listening and able to attend. And if you aren't able to attend, we do have a live streaming option on the Land Conservancy's Facebook page and YouTube page. So it's going to be an amazing evening, and we look forward to it. So come join us. It'll be great.
We're going to dive in with Ben in a moment. And Marisa, this hour, will tell us a little bit later about things like the New York State Wildlife Crossings Act. There are different efforts going on to address some of these issues. But generally speaking, when you see a book like this, Marisa, do you think your friends who are not in your line of work, do you think that it registers to them just how serious this issue is?
I would say probably not initially, but once you start to talk about it, and I mean, who can't relate to roadkill? Who doesn't see it in their day-to-day life? So once you start to really talk with people about what's going on and the plight that most of our wildlife species are dealing with right now, they really get interested. And I have recommended the book to many people at this point, and they've all been like, it's mind-blowing and eye-opening once you start reading about it.
Well, I want to start with Ben with another brief passage from your book, if you don't mind, Ben. You write about something called a frog shuttle, which we can talk about in a second. You write about the way that that work made you feel, but it's also challenging work that, for example, doesn't guarantee a good future for frogs. And you write, quote, the chief irony of biological annihilation is this. We are both its cause and its solution. Having curtailed wildlife migrations with our roads, we micromanage the survivors. We shuttle them in buckets from here to there, fence off roadsides, and direct animals to the few narrow crossings we permit them. We built roads to subjugate nature. And by the time we learned the consequences, we had no choice but to subjugate it further. we are forever at war with the world we have built, end quote. In the entire book, Ben, it felt like that passage might best sum up how you feel about human infrastructure. Is that fair?
It's certainly a memorable passage, and it was a really memorable experience that I had with the frog shuttle that you referenced. I was I visited this frog shuttle in Portland, Oregon, where there's this little population of northern red-legged frogs, and you know, like so many amphibians, they have to migrate. You know, they spend most of the year living up in this forest, and then they walk down to this wetland area to breed on warm, wet spring nights. And the problem is that in between those two habitats that they have to migrate between, there's a major federal highway, a couple of residential roads, a railroad track. It's sort of like a real life version of the video game Frogger. And so, you know, there are all of these really conservation minded Good Samaritans who go out and basically move those frogs around in buckets. They pick them up as they're approaching the road. They shuttle them to the breeding area. Then they put them back into buckets when the frogs are done breeding a few months later and take them back across the highway. And you know, these sorts of bucket brigades, they exist all over the country, especially in the Northeast. There are plenty in New York. You know, folks are out there moving spotted salamanders and wood frogs and snapping turtles and all kinds of critters. And, you know, it's a really wonderful, heartwarming thing. And I'm so glad those people are doing it. But as you alluded to, it's this symptom, really, or at least it addresses the symptom rather than the root cause of so many conservation problems, which is, you know, of course, those roads that we drove right through the middle of so many creatures' habitats. So, you know, this book is certainly solutions oriented. But, you know, the problem of roads and wildlife and nature is really an immense one.
Well, inevitably, some listeners will conclude, well, you know, this is the cost of progress. You know, humans are the top of the chain. And in one sense, this book reads like an appeal to people who think that way, to convince them that non-human lives are worthy of caring about. But separately, if we want to take a human-centric viewpoint, Ben, what do you think the impact is on human beings when road ecology wreaks havoc on animals?
The impact on us drivers is immense, right? I bet that every single person listening to this show has either hit a deer or at some point, or at least had a near miss with a deer, right? And, you know, in the state of New York alone, there are something like 65,000 reported deer collisions every year. That's something like a deer collision every 8 minutes, I think. So this is just, you know, truly this constant ubiquitous problem. Hundreds of drivers are killed in deer collisions every year. Deer are the single most dangerous animal in North America. And of course, it's not the deer's fault, right? It's the world we've created. But I think that just goes to show how frequent these deer vehicle collision incidents really are. You know, the average deer collision now costs society more than $9,000 in hospital bills and vehicle repairs and insurance costs and tow trucks and the rest of it. You know, we know that deer collisions and other large animal collisions are costing America more than $8 billion with a B every single year, right? So, you know, these incidents involving roads and drivers and traffic and wildlife, you know, yes, they are this form of biological annihilation, as you mentioned a moment earlier, but they're also, you know, I think this huge unsung public health and safety crisis that we're really obligated to deal with.
Do you also find, though, Ben, that you have to convince people to care about animals? I mean, I think a lot of people think of themselves as animal lovers, or if you ask most people, not all, but a lot of people would say, yeah, I love animals. But I think people have gotten used to just shrugging at the idea of roadkill and are not thinking bigger about, you know, big number losses. And in a moment, we'll talk too about not just the animals that die on the roads, but the animals that don't even go near the roads, the animals that change their patterns and their lives and their food sources and everything sort of on down. But do you find yourself struggling to convince people to care in the way that you do?
I don't think it's hard to convince people to care about wildlife, but I do think it's hard to convince people to change their driving habits, right? We live in this incredibly automotive society, you know, and we're all kind of part of the issue, right? We're all driving around out there because that's the world that we've created for ourselves. You know, I'm as much a hypocrite as anybody, right? This book came out almost a year ago now, and I've driven thousands of miles to promote my book about the ecological ills of driving, right? We live in a country with 4 million miles of road and a planet with 40 million miles of road, and we haven't invested nearly enough in alternative transportation solutions. And so, you know, I think that, look, nobody wants to hit a frog or a turtle or a deer or a raccoon or any animal. You know, those collisions can be traumatizing for the people involved, right? I know a guy who hit a squirrel a couple of years ago and was so kind of shell-shocked and confused that he called 911. He didn't know what else to do, right? So nobody wants to be in these situations, but we live on this planet where it's incredibly hard to avoid being in those situations, and it's just really difficult to escape the predicament that we've created for ourselves when we paved the planet.
Well, I take your point about all the driving you've had to do to promote this book, but you don't really have a mass transit option to do that in this country. And I think that I should not miss the opportunity to ask you if you think a systems change with transportation is much needed.
Yeah, I do, certainly. You know, obviously, I'm a believer in transit and investing more in pedestrianism and, you know, bicycling lanes and train and bus options. But, you know, I also recognize that that's not a panacea, right? And you know, certainly we should do a whole lot more of that. But, you know, these days, I grew up in the Hudson Valley, but, you know, today I live in rural Colorado, and it's just hard to imagine the bus or train system that is going to connect all of these far-flung towns in you know, the middle of the Rocky Mountains, right? Where, you know, we are to some extent stuck with the car. And, you know, I think that's where those wildlife crossings that you mentioned earlier come in. You know, can we modify our infrastructure building by building bridges and tunnels and culverts and other structures that allow animals to safely navigate the built world, so that in the places where driving is inevitable, you know, it's not as ecologically catastrophic as it is today. So, you know, certainly I think, you know, better transit and pedestrian options in you know, more suburban and urban areas and more wildlife crossings in the more rural areas like the place that I live, you know, those two kind of buckets of infrastructural work, I think, are so important.
Before I continue here, and I'm looking at my notes and it's like, well, we're going to get through, I don't know, half of what we want to get through. that just means then, listeners, you're going to have to pick up the book yourself if you want. Ben Goldfarb is our guest. The book is called Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. And they would love to see you 2 weeks from tonight, Wednesday, August 28th at 7 p.m. at the Trinity Episcopal Church in Buffalo. Ben will be there for an evening with conservation journalist Ben Goldfarb and the Western New York Land Conservancy, bringing this event to Western New York. So let me grab a phone call from Rich, who wants to jump in on some of this stuff. Hello, Rich. Go ahead.
Hello. How you doing, Evan?
Good, sir.
This is one of my passions, is about how we manage our land and how we live with the animals. I even think about, even in our backyard, Evan, I think Irondequoit is one of the worst examples of what he's talking about. We have this island of animals cut off from the world by 104 that has made their lives miserable. But also, I've seen those land bridges, but maybe, like you said, it might be hard, but maybe we become the bridges. Maybe we start building elevated highways and letting crossings in, I mean, long stretches, because even these bridges that you're talking about, when you have a predators and you have prey, that even stops them from crossing because of the fears they have of running into that predator or prey. All these things, all this comes into play. So maybe we should start making elevated highways that go 2 to 3 miles of elevation with animals crossing under. Maybe we should, you know, that's my thoughts on it. And also just concentrating human populations in smaller areas.
Well, Rich, you've screwed up my show notes here because you're jumping ahead here. But no, I mean, that's what happens when you have smart phone calls from smart listeners. It's a very, not only it's a very interesting observation, Ben writes a lot about possible solutions. There's not a silver perfect one out there, but and sometimes they don't work. We're going to talk about that. Sometimes a culvert doesn't work and they have to figure out why the toads didn't use them. They have to. it's not all perfect. But Rich, what you are talking about is something that has been considered. And I'm going to ask both of our guests. We'll jump ahead in my notes now. That's fine. Thank you, Rich. Ben, how do you feel about this idea of, he talked about elevated highways. We could talk about crossings, so underpasses, overpasses, et cetera. How good of a solution is that generally, Ben?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, and I love Rich's idea. And in fact, you know, there are places that have done that, you know, in India, for example, you know, where they're building out a lot of their major highways for the first time. They're actually doing exactly what Rich suggested. They're putting these highways on these giant concrete pillars for many miles so that animals like tigers and Asian elephants can actually wander the forest floor totally uninhibited. So, you know, Rich should be a consulting biologist for transportation departments. That's a great idea and one that's being done in some places. The problem is that, you know, here in the US, we obviously have this you know, this kind of decades old, very calcified freeway system, right? You know, we're just not going to do that in many places, even though that's the smart ecological thing. We're not going to rebuild our highways, unfortunately, on giant concrete pillars. And so, the best tool in our box for retrofitting those highways is, you know, adding those underpasses and overpasses where we can. And, you know, we know they're incredibly effective from lots of studies that have been done all over the country and the world. You know, typically those wildlife crossings have fences on either side, so the animals follow the fence line and the fences funnel them to the crossings. And, you know, typically where these structures are being built, they're reducing roadkill by more than 90%. They're often paying for themselves because, again, we know that these animal collisions are these really dangerous, expensive events. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you can build a crossing that prevents 40 or 50 of them a year, as many of these crossings do, you know, you can save the public a lot of money really quickly. And of course, we know they're great for wild animals, that they permit animals to keep moving around the landscape to find mates and food and habitat and all the things that all organisms need. So, you know, these crossings, you often hear the phrase win-win-win thrown around because, you know, they're good for the wildlife, good for driver safety, good for public funding, good for hunters, you know, who don't want to see deer hit any more than anybody else does. And so, you know, we know that, you know, these are really one of the most valuable tools that we have at our disposal for dealing with this problem.
And Marie Sirigi, Executive Director of the Western New York Land Conservancy, what is the New York State Wildlife Crossings Act?
So the New York State Wildlife Crossings Act is an act that has passed both the New York State Senate and the Assembly. It has yet to be signed by the governor, but fingers crossed it gets signed soon. And it is an act that empowers the DOT and the Thruway Authority to identify sites along highways, thruways, parkways in New York State that would be ideal places to have wildlife crossings. It also gives New York State the ability to start to access some of the federal funds that are available. I think there's $350 million allocated for wildlife crossings in the Federal Infrastructure and Jobs Act. And New York State hasn't accessed that funding yet because we don't have this bill and these prioritized areas yet.
Is there anything to indicate the governor won't sign it?
Just that she hasn't signed it yet.
Just the fact that she hasn't, yeah.
Okay. It passed, and we've all been kind of waiting with bated breath to see what happens. So,
okay, but she hasn't given an indication that she won't.
There's been no indication I know of either way.
Okay. Let me get Pam in Newark on the phone, who's been waiting as well. Hey, Pam, go ahead.
Hi, Evan. I think this problem goes back even farther before we had all these roads, because in New York State, the wolves were all killed off and there was an overpopulation of deer. So we really don't have too many deer. We have not enough wolves. So we were, you know, before the roads, all this traffic and everything, but I am definitely going to get a hold of his book and read it.
Yeah, thank you. Again, the book is called Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. You're going to really enjoy it, Pam, because he writes so beautifully, not just the prose, but the true love of of all animals and the way he interacts with them and the observations. We're going to talk more in a moment about some of those stories that I think are really poignant and important. So I think you're really going to enjoy it, but it also will probably disturb you a little bit. Marisa, do you want to weigh in? I know you wanted to weigh in on Pam's point about it's not that we have too many deer, it's that we don't have enough wolves.
Sure. So we certainly are lacking in wolves. I wouldn't disagree with that. We our predator-prey balance is a bit out of whack in western and central New York, and actually most of New York. And that's partially because of predators, but that's also because of the development that we've undertaken throughout the state, which roads are a huge part of that. So when we have more and more development breaking its way into core habitat areas, we create more and more edge habitat. And edge habitat favors generalist species like white-tailed deer. So it all goes hand in hand. Yes, we're lacking in predators, but we also have an overproliferation of deer because of the development that has gone on throughout New York State.
Anything you want to add there, Ben?
Well, you know, you have some smart listeners, Evan, because Pam is right. You know that there have been studies in places that do have wolves, like Wisconsin, where research actually found that wolves were reducing those deer herds and kind of chasing deer away from the roadsides enough to save the public about $11 million every year in avoided deer crashes. And there's been some research too about the potential economic benefits of having cougars back in the Northeast from a deer collision reduction perspective. So you've got some sharp listeners who are thinking about the right things and asking the right questions.
I went back after reading your book, I went back and pulled up. So I was not one of those people who watched all of The West Wing. But I remembered, and I don't know why it ever got on my radar in the first place as somebody who hasn't seen every episode of the show. But you write in your book about the way the West Wing mocked this idea of creating corridors, of passage corridors for animals. And so I went back and watched. And listeners, if you're a big fan of the West Wing, you know, I feel like all of Aaron Sorkin sounds the same. That's a whole separate conversation. But there's an episode where Sorkin does do a good job of making you at least interested in the minutiae of how policy gets created and the personalities. The problem is the scene is so bad because the people who care about wolves in this case, who want to create this corridor, there are these cliches of these humorless environmentalists who in 30 seconds of watching this scene, you're like, oh, I can't stand those people. You know, they're not interesting. They're barely human. And, you know, they're excoriating the White House staff for not caring enough about these wolves. And then they say, well, it's only going to cost you $900 million. And, you know, I mean, it's a ridiculous scene, but it has the sad thing is about that scene is it kind of made people sneer at environmentalists who care about animal protection, but it has roots in a real story that Ben back in 2013 was kind of investigating. Do you want to tell that story for people who are big West Wing fans to go back and rewatch that scene?
Yeah, so the West Wing fans among you will recognize the description of the wolves-only roadway, right? That was the proposal that those humorless environmentalists brought to the White House. And you know, I think you're right that I don't want to say that, you know, that Aaron Sorkin did, you know, serious dramatic harm to the cause of habitat connectivity and wildlife crossings. But, you know, he definitely misunderstood the concept, I would say, because, you know, in that episode, what those environmentalists are pitching is basically this dedicated road for wolves, right? And that, you know, has its roots, as you say, in a real story. There was this very famous wolf who was collared. They put a tracking collar on her in Canada. The wolf was named Pluie. And Pluie wandered, I forget how many thousands of miles, but basically walked an incredibly long distance and showed to conservation biologists, you know, how just the scale of the landscape that we need to connect and protect to allow these animals to, you know, safely do their thing. Because they're, you know, again, animals like wolves and bears and deer and moose, you know, they're using enormous swaths of habitat. So in the West Wing, you know, these environmentalists go in and say, well, hey, let's build this dedicated road just for wolves. You know, and it's going to cost, as you say, $900 million. But that's not, you know, what environmentalists are proposing, right? Nobody, you know, when we talk about wildlife crossings, we're not talking about, you know, building a 1,000-mile-long road for wolves. We're talking about, you know, taking the existing landscape that we already have, you know, the forests and in some cases agricultural fields and, you know, other habitats, and basically protecting land so that animals can safely move through those habitats. And then when those protected corridors of habitat intersect with a road, you know, that's where you build one of those wildlife crossings that's only, you know, 100 feet long, let's say, or 200 feet long. So Aaron Sorkin didn't totally understand the concept, but that episode is rooted in a real idea, which is that we need to connect and protect large landscapes for wildlife.
Can I ask you to talk a little bit about some of the other stories of animals and the devastation that roads cause? We can't do them all, but there's just a few that I think would be helpful to just illustrate for listeners. We're not just talking about deer. I mean, a lot of people think about deer, but monarch butterflies in Minnesota. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, butterflies are a really fascinating case study, because in some ways they're a different story than the usual animal getting smashed by roads, right? Because, you know, we know that in so many places, certainly including Western New York, you know, roadsides can be good habitat for animals. You know, there are wildflowers along roads and milkweed and, you know, and fruiting shrubs and other resources that, you know, pollinating insects or birds or small mammals are going to use, you know. And in some states in the Midwest, you know, roadsides are actually the largest form of public land. You know, they're kind of these oases of habitat in this ocean of, you know, corn and soy monoculture. So, you know, you can provide some pretty good opportunities for critters along those roadsides. Just the challenge, of course, is that the road is a hard place to live. You know, it's this very chemically complex environment, you know, full of road salt and other pollutants. It's also a dangerous place, obviously. Millions of monarch butterflies get hit by cars during their migration, even though we don't really think about insects as being roadkill. So, you know, the road is this, it's this ecosystem in its own right. It's a form of habitat, but it's also a very dangerous ecosystem potentially. And, you know, I think we need to think about whether our roadsides are producing more animals than they're, you know, potentially luring to their death. I think ultimately, you know, we can't ignore roadsides, because, you know, we live in this kind of habitat crisis. We need as many places for animals to live as we can manage. But, you know, we also have to be cognizant of the potential for those roadside habitats to be really dangerous places.
You got to be there observing this butterfly that was hit by a car before it could reproduce. And that was another little poignant moment in the book. Can you describe that?
Yeah, it was at once hopeful and a little bit tragic. It was this female monarch butterfly, and, you know, she was just looking for a milkweed along the roadside to lay her eggs, because, you know, the monarch caterpillar eats exclusively milkweed. And we actually did see her, lay an egg or two, which was heartening. But she's, you know, sort of getting buffeted by the slipstreams of traffic and, you know, barely avoiding cars as they come barreling down this road. And so it was, you know, that duality in a single place, this animal using the roadside to lay her eggs and reproduce, but, you know, also just being endangered by traffic at every turn. It was definitely like one of those heart in your throat moments, watching this poor tiny creature just flying through traffic.
And I was also really moved by the story of giant anteaters. This really is a road journal. You went far and wide for this. Tell us the story of giant anteaters.
Right. So giant anteaters live in Brazil. And that was one of the places that I went in working on this book. And, you know, giant anteaters, I mean, they're just incredible animals. Some listeners can probably picture them, but they have these long kind of tube-like snouts with this very long tongue that they use to, you know, lap up ants and termites and other insects. And, you know, they're almost like rotational grazers. They have these big territories, and they'll just wander from anthill to anthill or termite mound to termite mound, you know, eating their fill before the insects kind of retreat from them. And so, you know, because they have to sort of wander among all of these different food sources, they end up crossing the road a lot, you know, and Brazil is one of those places, you know, like India or Nepal or Kenya, you know, this country that's building out a lot of new highways right now. Right here in the US, you know, we're not building a ton of new highways. We're mostly stuck with the ones that we have. But, you know, a lot of these very fast developing countries are creating new infrastructure now. And you know, the challenge there is that, you know, Brazil is the most biodiverse country in the world, right? So there's this kind of inherent tension between developing new infrastructure for the benefit of humans and potentially endangering anteaters and a lot of that wildlife. And, you know, I think what's happening in Brazil that's exciting is that, you know, they're doing it right from the get-go in some places. You know, they're building these roads that are kind of animal-friendly to start with. They include wildlife crossings. You know, in some places, the roads are actually, they have lots of hairpin turns to kind of slow drivers down for the sake of animals. Some of the roads in Brazil are actually closed at night for wildlife. And so, you know, that's a place that I think is learning from some of the ecological mistakes that we made here in the U.S. And developing right from the get-go, at least in some places, certainly not all.
We're going to talk a little bit more about some of these solutions that the book details coming up here with our guest, Ben Goldfarb, who is a journalist and an author of Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. Pat from Geneva called in to say that he had to pick up a turtle yesterday on the road that had been hit by a car. And Scott in Seneca Falls wants to weigh in as well. Hello, Scott. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I did a lot of bike touring in the past, so I got to, you know, see all those, you know, excesses of our car travel. I got to see some amazing owls that I would never have seen probably that close out west. And I know one point I've taken away, just looking back on that, I've heard say, you know, it's all about littering and that causes a lot of animals to come to the road. But that's obviously a small point to your guest's larger picture. I guess my question to him, and I kind of like thought this from the get-go of listening to the show at the moment, is kind of like the underpinnings of what holds us from happening. You're talking about like India and they're, you know, they're starting their infrastructure plans, but I feel like they come at it from a different place as far as how they view animals. And I'm sure the book probably tackles some of these questions, but is that at all a major roadblock to you as far as this happening?
Thank you, Scott. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, you know, I think that I'm really glad that Scott had that cycling experience. And, you know, I'm not sure this is going to totally get at his question, but, you know, I think that one of the really striking things about driving is that you just don't really see very much, right? We're sealed in our little, you know, glass and metal bubbles. We're racing along at 70 miles an hour. And, you know, maybe you see the dead deer or raccoon or the bigger critters, but, you know, you don't see, I mean, Scott mentioned those birds, you know, the owls that you see along roadsides, which get hit, or songbirds, or, you know, or snakes, right? You don't see those smaller critters because you're moving at such a high speed. Whereas when you ride a bicycle or walk along a highway, you know, you see those smaller animals. And so I think there's a kind of a perceptual issue in a sense. You know, we don't fully understand the ecological consequences of roads and appreciate them, in part because we move along them at these very inhuman high rates of speed. You know, speed is both killing animals and, in a sense, blinding us to the realities of everything we're killing. And, you know, when you're on a bike, you know, riding around the country, as Scott was, you just understand the scope of the problem in a totally new way.
Let me ask Scott if he wants to add anything there. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, I totally take that point. I'm just still curious about, I think it's hard for me to, I mean, I would be interested in reading the book to know more, but just like these solutions actually being put in place, just because I feel like, I don't know, as a nation, I know like dogs and cats have been getting more attention and respect over time, but just something with like the American view on the animal kingdom. I feel like we're coming up to speed, but just not in a way that, I don't know, making those major changes.
Scott, it sounds like, tell me if I'm wrong, it sounds like part of what you're saying is anybody who has ever been driving and hit a dog or a cat It's probably something you'll never forget, and it is probably a devastating experience. If you hit a deer, you're probably annoyed about possible damage to your car or worried about injury to yourself. If you hit other animals, I don't want to say you don't care. I'm saying the place of the dog and the cat in the American psyche is in a very different place. And if you hit somebody's house pet that you think is right outside their house, it's a very different feeling than if you hit, yeah, a raccoon, if you hit others. And it sounds like you're saying that that is both the current situation and maybe an impediment to us creating more solutions that value animals. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it's very like a Western, you know, species-centric idea. You know, dog and cats, they've sort of, you know, got in our circle. But, yeah, I just look to the Eastern world maybe having a different idea on the greater picture, and I can totally see them doing what's happening in the book that's being explained.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just coming up to that place where we're really going to, you know, be making those major changes, because I'd love to see it, but I just don't know if I can believe in the same respect that your guest is. But thank you for taking the call.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. I really appreciate that. So, Ben, you want to build on that, and then kind of that leads us into some of the solutions that you do want people to know more about. We've been talking about some of them, but go ahead.
Yeah, certainly. You know, I think that Scott's point that we value some animals differently than others, you know, you see that reflected in wildlife crossings, right? I mean, in Colorado where I live, and Wyoming and Utah and Montana, other Western states, you know, we've built lots of wildlife crossings, but they're almost entirely for deer and elk and antelope, you know, these big animals that mess your car up when you hit them, right? We're building wildlife crossings to help wildlife, yes, but we're also doing it to promote driver safety. And, you know, and that's great, right? We need many more of those passages. But, you know, we also haven't really done a whole lot for the smaller animals, right? We haven't done a whole lot for those turtles and frogs and salamanders, you know, those creatures that are existentially threatened by traffic, but, you know, don't really pose much of a risk to us as drivers, right? Nobody's ever, you know, totaled their car by hitting a spotted salamander, right? And so, you know, I think that in some ways, you know, we do need to do what Scott is suggesting and take this more holistic view of the animal kingdom. And yes, let's build lots more wildlife crossings for deer and elk and moose, but, you know, let's also start building some for the smaller cold-blooded animals that, you know, society hasn't always valued. And if you go to other countries, you know, you see that sort of thing. In some countries, there are wildlife overpasses for crabs, which, you know, migrate across highways going to the beach. There are hundreds of toad tunnels in places like the Netherlands and the UK and Germany. So other countries are thinking about those smaller critters in some cases more than we are, I think.
Well, there's Pat in Geneva who wants to tell that story. Go ahead, Pat.
Hi. So I disconnected myself earlier. So I picked up a turtle, excuse me, yesterday. I saw it in the road. I was going from Geneva to Waterloo. So I'm right along the canal where you might expect painted turtles. And it was in the middle of the road. And by the time I stopped and went back, someone had hit it. I did get it to a wildlife rehabilitator, so hopefully it will survive. But I wanted to make a point about the roadside being a great place for butterflies. And part of the reason that is you can drive around here where I live and see people with large properties with vast lawns. And the only available pollinator-friendly plants for a lot of these butterflies and bees and such are along the roadside. So maybe if more of these people would devote some portion of their property to pollinator-friendly gardens, the animals wouldn't have to be right along the roadbed. And that's my comment.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Pat. Thank you. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, there's research showing that monarch butterflies and other pollinators, yes, they certainly use those roadsides. They'll lay their eggs there and feed there, but they're less productive in the roadsides than they are in other parts of the landscape, which, you know, of course, aren't so dangerous. So, you know, I'm with Pat. If you said, okay, you know, here's money to restore 100 acres of roadside or 100 acres of lawn, you know, I would restore the lawn first. So I'm with Pat on that one.
And Pat, the fact that you stopped to help a turtle who was hit yesterday, you got a good heart. I admire that. I appreciate that. And good luck to you, Pat. Thank you. Gloria, speaking of butterflies, has the story to tell. Hello, Gloria in Canandaigua.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This happened a couple of years ago. I have gardens front and back and probably plant way too many things, but I also allow the milkweed to grow in many places because, you know, all of the pollinators need that. And I at one point saw that the butterfly had put its eggs on the bottom of a leaf, and then, you know, life went on. And you know, I did see caterpillars and stuff, but then the next year or so I was out there the same spot basically where the butterfly had put its eggs, and there's a monarch butterfly that came right in front of me, and it was fluttering, and I swear it was saying thank you.
There's a story. Ben, what do you think?
Yeah, I love that idea, you know, and I think that, you know, what a lot of these listener stories are illustrating is that people have this really strong desire to help wildlife, right? I mean, yes, it's hard to do that in our day-to-day lives because we're all kind of driving around, you know, committing roadkill. I've certainly done plenty of that, but ultimately, you know, people have really good hearts, and you know, there's a story that I tell in the book that I read in the Atlantic, I think, where you know, at one point, Mr. Rogers, of course, the, you know, incredible legendary television personality, you know, he was, you know, he basically heard this anecdote about, you know, about people helping a snapping turtle off a highway. And, you know, he basically said, you know, look, that's an incredible story, right? It doesn't seem like much, but, you know, people want to know that there's this, I think, grace at the heart of creation was the phrase that he used. You know, people want to hear inspiring stories about, you know, other humans helping wildlife. I think those kinds of stories are really motivating and powerful. And so, you know, when I hear about somebody planting milkweed for pollinators or helping a turtle across a highway, I mean, that's sort of where the work of conservation begins. You know, ultimately, I think we need these bigger infrastructural solutions like roadside fences and wildlife crossings. But, you know, the kinds of people who support those bigger solutions are the kinds of people who plant milkweed for monarchs. And so, you know, conservation does kind of begin in your backyard at the very grassroots level.
Ingrid in Penfield is next on the phone. Hello, Ingrid.
Hi, thanks so much for doing this program. It's close to my heart. I'm one of those milkweed planters and have, you know, find myself defending this to the town and to neighbors who are, you know, looks more like a golf course at their home. And I am wondering whether support, and not just financial support, but emotional support, an activity seems to fall down partisan lines for this kind of project, or haven't you found that, which would be great news?
Very good questions, and it goes on different levels here. Let me start with Marisa Rigi, who's the executive director of the Western New York Land Conservancy. Has there been any partisanship over, take for example, in New York, the New York State Wildlife Crossings Act?
Yeah, that act was actually a bipartisan supported act and has been supported by Republicans and Democrats across the state and signed through. So we're just waiting for the governor to sign it. But, you know, wildlife crossings are one of the topics in New York State and across different states in this country where you find bipartisan support because there are benefits to wildlife and there are benefits for people as well.
Okay. Ben, how about other levels of government? What have you observed?
Yeah, I think Marisa is absolutely right. I mean, you know, you think about, Marisa mentioned earlier, there's, you know, this $350 million pot of grant funding for wildlife crossings in the 2021 Federal Infrastructure Act. You know, and that language was originally introduced by John Barrasso, a Republican senator from Wyoming. You know, and I mean, I think that's one of the great things about this issue is that it, you know, it truly unites the hunting lobby and the Humane Society, right? Nobody wants to
to hit animals. Everybody supports wildlife crossings. And at the state and federal level, you know, it really is one of the few places that, as Marisa said, you see truly bipartisan agreement. You know, in Colorado, where I live, 85% of residents, according to one recent poll, support more wildlife crossings. And you couldn't get 85% of people to agree that the sky is blue at this point, right? So I think that just tells you how truly universal this issue is.
Marisa, I don't know if you've noticed, I haven't even mentioned the phone number for the show today, and our phone rang off the hook. There is tremendous interest in what Ben Goldfarb is bringing to our community, and the phone's been ringing, we've got emails, people want to talk about this issue. Ben's the author of Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. And 2 weeks from tonight, it's an evening with conservation journalist Ben Goldfarb. It's happening at 7 p.m. in Buffalo at the Trinity Episcopal Church. You want to tell people a little about what you're looking forward to in 2 weeks?
Sure. We are looking forward to Ben talking about everything, all the amazing things you've been hearing about today and more about the book and wildlife crossings and what we can do in Western New York and Central New York to benefit wildlife and to make these crossings a reality. I do want to mention that if you're planning on attending, please do go to our website to register, because there is a limit. So please log on and register. Our
website?
Is wnylc.org.
wnylc.org. LC for the Land Conservancy. So WNYLC.org for tickets information. It's all there.
Yes.
2 weeks from tonight with Ben Goldfarb, an evening with conservation journalist Ben Goldfarb, happening in Buffalo. And it's going to be a beautiful night, great night for a road trip for Rochesterians. Although, you know, we're trying to dissuade you from driving. They're going to give you a pass if you go out that night. No, I mean, look, the reality, and you've heard Ben say this hour, the reality is it's difficult with the infrastructural setup that we have in this country. This has been, you know, decades of conversation that I've observed with members of Congress and the public about, do we build mass transit and who pays for it? Do we just upgrade Amtrak or do we do a whole new thing? There's a state level conversation happening, and State Senator Jeremy Cooney is at the forefront of that. But that's going to be, you know, expensive. He'll tell you that, as he has said on this program, he thinks it's worth exploring in many ways. But we're a long ways away from changing our infrastructural habits. And that's why we need to talk about solutions to these issues, which, by the way, are not new. They've exploded in the last century. But Ben writes that even the ancient Romans saw the impact of road building with the Via Cassia, which was a little tidbit that I thought was fascinating, Ben. Even the ancient Romans had to deal with this.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically that early Roman road, you know, it caused sediment runoff, which you know, ended up in a local lake and changed the lake's whole ecosystem, right? So, you know, we've been talking a lot about the impacts of traffic on wildlife, but roads are also these physical structures that change the landscape, you know, in hydrological and even geological ways, even when there are, you know, no cars on them. You know, in here in Colorado, you know, we have thousands of miles of old logging and mining road that, you know, don't get a whole lot of use, but they're constantly kind of bleeding sediment into wetlands and streams and rivers, and, you know, impacting fish habitat and water quality and other issues. So this, you know, this field of road ecology, which studies all of the different connections between roads and nature. Yes, you know, certainly a lot of that is about traffic and roadkill, but, you know, that's in some ways just the tip of the iceberg.
You also mentioned, before I let you go here, you also write in your book, in a chapter called Reparations, excuse me, a lot about what's going on in Syracuse, but you mentioned cities that have had to deal with their own issues of roadways, including Rochester and the Interloop here. So the eastern third of the Interloop was filled a number of years ago. The northern third is next. There's still a lot of debate about, you know, what exactly happens to that space, but it's happening. This sunken stretch of highway that divided in, you know, neighborhoods of human beings, to say nothing of animals. But, you know, you write a lot about Syracuse as well. What would you want listeners to know about the Syracuse story?
Yeah, you know, and certainly, look, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, the local listeners know that story a lot better than I do. But to me, you know, the Syracuse story is really emblematic of the history of urban freeway construction in the U.S., right? I mean, all over the country, you know, new highways in the middle of the 20th century fragmented and divided natural ecosystems kind of incidentally. But in our cities, you know, freeways were really weaponized and used very deliberately against communities of color. And that was, you know, certainly the case in Syracuse, where I-81 and the viaduct was used to displace Black residents in the 15th Ward, historically the city's largest Black neighborhood. And, you know, that viaduct has really long-lasting repercussions, right? There are health issues. You know, I talked to many people with asthma as a result of the air pollution from that, you know, that viaduct. And there are, you know, I mean, Syracuse is one of the most segregated cities in the country. And part of that is the, you know, the kind of the wall of the freeway that that runs through the middle of the city. And so, you know, I think in a lot of ways, you know, the story of how freeways and interstates affected nature and how they affect mm-hmm. human communities, it's, you know, it's kind of they're analogous or parallel stories, right? I mean, you know, highways, yes, they're these tools of connection that connect communities and allow us to move between them, but they also divide communities, both human communities and natural communities. And, you know, part of our responsibility is healing that damage.
All right, I'm going to squeeze this last comment in. Tim says, one perspective is that roadkill might help other wildlife to survive. I expect some populations to thrive as a result of roadkill. Because the food web was disrupted by human activity, cars could serve as a way to regulate populations, in some ways replacing the wolves mentioned by a prior caller. All right, you got about 30 seconds, Ben. What do you make of Tim saying that you know, roadkill can help other wildlife survive?
Yeah, you know, certainly you think about scavenging animals, right? Bald eagles or ravens or magpies, you know, they're using that carcass resource. But again, it's a dangerous resource. You know, imagine being a bald eagle with a belly full of venison, right? It takes you a little while to achieve liftoff. And so you're at risk of being hit by a car yourself. So again, you know, the road's an ecosystem, but it's a pretty dangerous, unnatural ecosystem.
I want to thank our guests for joining us this hour. Ben Goldfarb, the book is called Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. And we'll see you in Buffalo 2 weeks from tonight for an evening with Ben Goldfarb, brought to you by the Western New York Land Conservancy. Ben, thank you for being generous with your time.
Thanks so much, Evan.
And I want to thank as well Marisa Rigi, who is the executive director of the Western New York Land Conservancy, doing a lot of hard work in our area. Thank you for doing that, and good luck with this event in a couple of weeks. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Hope to see you there.
It is WNYLC.org for the website. More information on the event 2 weeks from tonight. From the whole team at Connections, thanks for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.